Hi, I'm Ivan Reitman. I'm the director and producer.
Harold Ramis, writer and actor.
Hi, Joe Medzik, associate producer.
And welcome to Ghostbusters, the original.
Columbia Lady.
The old Columbia Lady.
Now, we actually shot this in New York with the real public library. Unfortunately, there was scaffolding up everywhere because they were cleaning the building. And part of the look of the film was to use the gargoyles of the city.
But these people are animatronic.
They're not real, are they?
No.
But this is the New York Public Library, upstairs in it. They let us in until 10 in the morning, so we had to work very quickly. And this handsome young man is me, 15 years ago, crossing the screen.
And through the magic cinema, as she walks down the stairs, we are now shooting, of course, in the Los Angeles Public Library.
And we're about to see
a very expensive special effect coming up.
Any second.
This will knock your socks off.
It actually knocked my socks off when I watched it. It looked real, real fine.
Yeah,
there we go.
There it goes.
Books on a wire.
That's right. Everybody thinks it's an expensive optical.
$250,000.
You should have seen the rig just above the stacks right there. But it was very impressive. All this stuff was not done optically. None of this was done optically. All of it was done.
Now, this is an incredible effect.
Chuck Gasper.
She's walking past. The wall is fake. Behind the wall are technicians who are going to push these drawers open. And then they're using copper tubing. They're blowing air through the drawers to blow the cards out one at a time.
And it worked most of the time.
Worked very well. Picking up the cards after every take.
that was the most fun watching.
A little time consuming.
A big group of people running in. But it's amazing. Sometimes the most simple and most practical stuff is the most effective.
And I wrote that moment. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Just as is. There she goes. Yeah, but were you the Steadicam operator?
No, that was good.
More air blown. A lot of air blown in this movie. There
true.
He is.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
You notice yet another statue? This statuary, as Ivan was saying, Gothic statuary all over this movie.
Yeah, it was the iconography of the movie. Yeah.
And here we are at, there's no Weaver Hall, but this is Columbia University.
And even this was at Columbia, wasn't it?
Venkman Burn in Hell. That was also in the script that it was
written
on the
door. Did you write that one too? Yeah, how about the maid thing?
That was a set dressers.
And this was based on a real experiment you knew about, wasn't it, Harold?
This scene we based on the Milgram experiment, which was to psychological subjects in a psychological study were instructed to give electric shocks to people trying to learn lists of words. But what they were really testing was the people's willingness to give electric shocks to other people. So I thought
hard to absorb an electric shock, I think.
Right. So this scene was about testing the audience's ability to accept their hero giving electric shocks unfairly to his test subject. I don't know, how far will they let Bill Murray go?
Yeah.
They let Bill Murray
go. Really liked
this thing.
Yeah. He liked doing it, I think.
And this was actually a room at Columbia University. We were planning to shoot it on the set, but we were moving so fast in New York that we went to our cover sets, which John DeCure, I think, had aged it. But otherwise, it's actually in the basement somewhere at Columbia.
What I love about this scene is it really, you know, set Bill's character so well right off the bat, this sort of very ironic, slightly shady guy who really doesn't believe in any of the real powers and science that the other Ghostbusters develop.
A self-serving charlatan.
Jeez, where'd that come from?
I think these kids were great, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that first time they worked, Jennifer Runyon, the actress, ended up starring in a number of films after this.
Oh, when he spits his gum out.
There was a lot of conversation, I remember, about just when the spitting of the gum moment should occur. Should it be on the first, the second, the third shock? We used it as a climax moment.
Pissing me off! Well, then maybe my theory is
Keep your $5. If I will.
That's comedy timing. When does the gum get spit out?
Uh-huh.
It's the kind of resentment that you're filled with.
It's Mr. Romeo himself.
Do you think I have it?
Yeah.
Your notebook.
I think Bill does very well with women.
What?
And our star, Danny Aykroyd.
The heart of the Ghostbusters.
Speaking of heart, I mean, one of the things we talked about during the writing sessions was how to divide the various functions, you know, the philosophy and the feelings and the emotions of the three guys. And Harold, right here, raise your hand, Harold. This is the brains.
That was the brains.
That's the brains. And Danny was the heart.
There, man.
Danny was the heart, and of course the mouth, Mr. Murray.
Buried the needle.
Dan loves speeches like this. This is good.
Danny would write these for other people, and they'd come in and they couldn't read them. And he'd say, "What's wrong?" And he'd take it and he'd read it, and it would sound absolutely fine.
And, you know, Danny insisted on this spectacular haircut of his as well.
Right. Full torso vaporous apparition. Or FRVP, free roaming vaporous phantasm.
We all went up to, where was it?
Martha's Vineyard.
Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah.
The story of the making of this movie actually it all happened very, very quickly. Danny Aykroyd wrote a 40-page treatment. That happened over years and years, which I was fortunate enough to get sent to me. And I think he wrote it originally for he and...
Tom Belushi.
That's right, he and Belushi. And unfortunately, Belushi passed away before they could make that movie. And when I read it, you know, it took place in the future with tons of...
Wait, my entrance.
Oh, sorry, I don't want to interrupt. I'll come back to that.
It's not an entrance, I'm discovered there.
Right. Oh, there he is.
Even better than it. Oh, there he is, right there.
We'll talk about my haircut later.
You invented that haircut, didn't you?
The French hairdresser, the French Moroccan hairdresser you found. Peggy Semtab.
I know, but I noticed you started going with that look for quite a few years after that.
Tall hair. It was big for a while.
And it became very popular with the sort of punk set right there.
Yes. A punk intellectual set. I was always stopped for autographs by guys with wire-rimmed glasses and real tall hair.
No, but I remember some guys in New York seeing you and yelling, "Yay, Brainiac!"
That's right.
I think it was, "Yo, Brainiac!"
Yo, Brainiac! Here we are. This is still the same day shooting upstairs in the New York Public Library.
All before 10 o'clock.
All before 10 o'clock, exactly.
Have you or any member of your family ever been diagnosed schizophrenic?
People love his interview scene with her, I know.
She's very good.
Are you Alice currently menstruating?
What's that got to do with anything?
And then it's like a t-shirt line. Back off, right. Man. I'm a scientist.
It was a t-shirt line.
This movie probably had more t-shirt lines than almost any movie.
I knew we were a hit, actually, when the second weekend of release, when I was walking through Manhattan, there were sort of... kiosks at every corner with guys selling legal black market t-shirts with sayings from the movie and the logo on it. This piece of equipment, only Harold got to learn how to use it. He had a sort of secret way to use the three buttons that were on it that made the little wings rise and fall.
And that's what acting is all about, really.
Okay, good.
Funny hair and props.
This next special effect, this one right here, I thought was pretty spectacular.
Now, Ivan, this is your idea. You were driving to the set. You got to the set and told them to do this, I remember.
And then a lot of this dialogue is improvised.
Vertical stacking.
Then it's symmetrical book stacking.
Always in character. This is the first time we see the three Ghostbusters before the fourth one joins, you know, working together. And it really sets the tone for the whole movie.
I love the timeless look of the wardrobe, the lighting. You know, there's something out of time about the movie.
Of course.
That's the slime.
The slime came in a very large bucket that a few of the grips would walk around and pour judiciously on various things. Never enough.
It's methyl cellulose, Chinese food starch.
More slime, more slime. Was the call on
it's
the
about this moment when... Billy gets some on his hand that we had to. I remember the first screening, the audience starts going, ooh, and freaking out, and that's when we knew we had a hit.
This way. Come on.
One take. One take, Bill.
Yeah.
Didn't want any more snot. Oh, this is great.
Egon, your mucus.
This happened to you before? First time?
You'll have to tell the story of how we all came together later.
Yeah. I'll continue that story that you interrupted with your entrance. But the but this this first moment of seeing the librarian and the librarian shift, I remember our first screening, our first test screening was only 3 weeks after we finished shooting. We edited the movie very quickly. It really came together very nicely. And we didn't have many of our special effects, but we did have this one right here. Actually, not so much this one, but the one that's coming up, the transformation. And when we screened it for this audience of about 200 people at Columbia Studios, they just freaked out and then both screamed and laughed at the same time. And it was a sense of how the movie was going to work, both being truly scary and also really funny.
Now, I noticed the sides of the stacks are things John DeCure put up to age them. Even though they were real stacks, they weren't real enough for him, so he was adding things to it.
John DeCure, the production designer.
Right.
I have to point out, we improvise a lot of the time, which doesn't mean totally ad-lib, but we work around the script for a lot of these moments here.
Hello. And just play into the characters that were very sort of strongly delineated.
But you'd get together, the three of you and Ivan, and work on the lines before the camera started rolling is when you would...
Yeah.
Often we would.
Sometimes, perhaps not. I would say, well, do something different, Harold. Come on, Bill, just something, anything.
Now, Ivan was very good at understanding the improvisational process and, you know, being a part of it.
Had you worked with, you'd worked with Bill in Chicago. Hadn't you?
I worked with Bill in Chicago and in New York in the Lampoon show.
All right.
Now, that effect of her lunging out and turning grotesque was even worse, wasn't it?
You mean more horrible?
Yeah.
No, it's about as horrible as we could make it, actually. The
I thought you had to pull it back a little bit.
No, this was the first day of principal photography. Now, it was the one thing that scared little kids. It's actually the scariest thing in the movie. And...
I thought Bill was the scariest thing on the making of the movie.
So going back to that, the development of the story, when I read that very first sort of treatment, it took place in the future. There were many groups of Ghostbusters. The Marshmallow Man came on page 20 and was just one of maybe 50 large-scale monsters. Frankly, if one was going to make that particular script, it would have cost $300 million in 1984. And... but there was one this fabulously brilliant idea, which was that there was a group of men who worked much like firemen who could catch ghosts. And I remember sitting down at a deli with Danny and saying, look, this is a great idea. You should work on it some more. Why don't you get Harold Ramis involved in this? Because I think, and he ought to be a Ghostbuster as well. He'd be great. He's got, you know, just the right sort of brilliance to him. And let's bring Billy into it at the end. And he went with that. And about a month later, we were making this picture.
That's right.
Do you remember?
You were writing it a month.
Dan's idea.
No, we were making it. You know, we were writing it and we were making it.
We had special effects on it right away.
I went into Frank Price, who was the head of Columbia's Pictures office, and I said, okay, we're going to do this movie. It's called Ghostbusters. This is sort of what the story is about, because we, of course, did not have a script at that time. And he said, what will it cost? I said $30 million. It was just a number off the top of my head, because that was way more money. That's three times as much money as I'd spent on my last movie. And he said, fine, as long as you have it out by June. And that was exactly 12 months from that moment. We had no script, no special effects team, but we had three willing actors.
And a contract. And we, Aykroyd said, why don't you guys come up to Martha's Vineyard? I'll rent houses for you. He had a place up there. So we got there. There was groceries in the refrigerators, cars in the driveways. We wrote for 3 weeks, I think. Every morning we went to Dan's bunker under his house.
You know, Dan always had this wonderful sort of service mentality. He always wanted to make us feel very comfortable and... you know, the full fridge was just the first step of everything. And I remember back fondly to those 3 weeks as one of the most fun time I've ever had in the film business.
It was great.
It was really great. We would go out to dinner with our families every night, and then we would sort of hide in this basement all day long, sort of trying to come up with this story that we had to start shooting in 2 months.
Dan, on the way up to his house, there's a military checkpoint, and then his basement was painted camouflage.
I remember because we finished in the library at 10 a.m., we then went outside, took a break, went outside, shot the outside of the library, and then shot this same scene the end of that day.
Oh, and I should point out also that in Dan's original script, there was no development of the Ghostbusters as parapsychologists in working in the university, starting up the company. All this stuff was, Ivan and I both had the idea that we wanted to see how the Ghostbusters got to be Ghostbusters and
material. I always thought the movie should be a going into business story. You know, it's three really smart guys who go into some business. It's just a very unusual business. So I like the idea of having to go to a bank, finding a place, dealing with a realtor, fixing the place up. I thought these were all things that an audience could relate to.
More creative geography. This is an actual old firehouse in Los Angeles, but the exterior is an actual in-use firehouse in New York.
Coincidentally, built the same year, 1912, both firehouses. So that's why it's one reason it's a great match, I think, too.
And it's true, as soon as we did see this pole, Danny said we have to use it. It wasn't just a moment in the movie.
One thing about starting as in a university setting, I think it helped bring the audience from a place of what's real to what's unreal. The credibility was established in the beginning.
Yeah, we used to call that the domino theory of reality. As long as you took the people step by step through a series of credible choices, you could start to believe that this sort of stuff can happen.
Fantasy rooftops.
And this is not a real... this was added optically, this gargoyle. More of the... Gothic architecture we were adding to New York.
Ah, Sigourney Weaver.
Ah, yay!
Now, Sigourney Weaver really wanted to be in this film. She wanted to do a comedy up to this point. She had played only in serious roles in films. And actually came and was a fairly large star. I think she had already done Alien.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And actually agreed to audition for the part. She came into my office. And I don't think I'm giving anything away by saying, you know, that she turns into a dog at some point in this film. And I remember her getting up on the couch and actually auditioning as a dog, and I knew at that point that she had to be in the film.
Uh-huh.
And our good friend Rick Moranis.
Yeah, Rick brought so much to this part.
Now, the part was originally written for John Candy. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
We called up John and said, John, you got to be in this. You know, Harold's in it. Harold and John had worked together in SCTV up in Canada.
And we'd done Stripes with Ivan and Bill.
And all of us had worked in Stripes, and it was only natural that he should be in this film, and John didn't understand this part. He kept coming back and saying, well, maybe if I played him in German, I would a German accent, and he would have Rottweilers. And I said, you can't have dogs. We have too much other dog imagery in the movie. And he finally passed on the film. Rick Moranis, who had been sent the script by his agent, was waiting patiently in the wings, and was very happy when John passed.
Yeah. Yeah. But we changed the character a lot. Rick really helped create this character.
Oh, he wrote some fine speeches for this character, too.
And I think chose the wardrobe.
This hallway is a set. This is a great John DeCure, yeah. Art Deco set.
Oh, I love this. This is where Harold looks for his mark.
Now, that wasn't... that was actually comedy thing.
Yeah, acting. That was comedy acting. I didn't... This is an interior set with the world's biggest backdrop around this.
This is actually one of my favorite moments in the movie because it sort of combines sort of the comedy of this phony sort of TV ad, which had just this wonderful sort of sense about it, and the start of something truly scary right over here.
Now, you have to notice what she took out of her bag were Stay Puft Marshmallows.
Yeah, what a nice detail that is.
Thank
so
you.
I'm in front of
I'm Harold. Blocking
in front of Harold.
Stay Puft Marshmallows. There they are. Yeah, Stay Puffed.
Here's the eggs.
And there's the man. You're going to see him later.
Again, another natural effect. Today, you know, all this sort of stuff would be done digitally. We had to figure out how to do this in a very sort of practical way. The art of special effects was really just at the Star Wars had come out and had made amazing leaps, but we were still at a very early stage.
Yeah, eggs cooking themselves on the countertop.
That counter was really hot.
Fortunately, Ivan had produced the magic show and directed Merlin on Broadway, so he knew a lot of these tricks.
And I ate a lot of fried eggs, so.
It was the famous refrigerator.
At that very first screening that we talked about, this next special effect was not available. And so when the first audience that saw this test screening went to that shot, it only said scene missing, and they just freaked out. It was the best response we ever had to the screening. I always thought that we ought to take this crappy effect shot out and leave the scene missing.
Van in the ambulance.
Oh, wow. The amazing thing about this ambulance was, I don't know.
Did Danny buy it finally?
I don't know.
No.
But we only had one of them. And I would, you know, no one making a movie would only have one of a kind. It's this old and isn't liable to run. I think it finally broke down in one shot crossing a bridge in Ghostbusters 2.
Dan is a vehicle freak and has many police vehicles, fire vehicles. He has amphibious cars. He's got everything. Lots of motorcycles.
Annie Potts, this is prior to her success as a television star, one of her first acting roles. Was a great addition to the cast.
Yeah, she was very funny.
Her sort of real sort of dry, deadpan sense of humor played so well against Bill and the rest of the guys.
His attitude with her is great.
Oh, another, you keep making these surprise entrances.
This was supposed to be the beginning of a romantic line between the two of us, which never quite materialized. It was a little mawkish and kind of a little too sappy, but they're intimations of something going to happen between us that at least got a couple laughs.
But you believed it in your heart.
Yeah.
How did you pick your name? Egon
Harold. Egon Spengler. The Egon came from Egon Donsbeck, who I went to school with, who was a Hungarian refugee, and Spengler was from Oswald Spengler. No. When Bill leaps over the rail, he almost doesn't make it. You'll hear his foot click on the railing. If he'd fallen, he would have been dead. Remember?
And perhaps someone else as well.
Yeah.
He would have taken a few people with him.
Here he comes. Here he comes. Get ready. Listen for the click.
Can I help you? Great answer.
Here he comes.
Here he comes. He's going to make it. Whoa!
Oh.
And he really was out of breath.
She elevated the tone of his acting, I think, tremendously. I think she helped, you know, get his performance up to there.
Absolutely. And she brings a great sense of reality to everything she does. We did all this live as well. There really was something attached to her that caused this solarization effect. It's kind of a cheapo effect, but it kind of worked.
And once you get funny hair, funny props, I'm telling you, it's the key to great acting. Olivia understood that. Brando knew it.
You know what it could be? Past life experience intruding on present time.
Could be erased memories stored in the collective unconscious. It wouldn't rule out clairvoyance or telepathic contact either.
I don't believe in any of this.
And this is the start of the... the other romantic relationship in this film. And Bill really took to it.
Go to Hall of Records and check out the structural details in the building. Maybe the building itself has a history of psychic turbulence.
Right. Sigourney always thought of herself as the Margaret Dumont of this story. You know, she thought of the other Ghostbusters as the Marx Brothers, and that her job was sort of to keep the sort of realistic center of the film and the story.
Yeah, her credibility really helps tremendously.
Yes. This top is an optical. The building exists, but it doesn't have a top.
Now, let me say something about the rooftop. We were thinking about what would be the center of the disturbance, and we're there different kinds of buildings or places all over the city. And I don't know if this is how it occurred to everyone, but I remembered a rooftop in St. Louis, which was a replica of a temple, and we started talking about the rooftops of New York.
Oh, right, right, right.
And someone produced a coffee table book called
Gargoyles and
Rooftops of
yeah.
New York. And we saw all these interesting temples on tops of buildings and strange Gothic structures, and they went with that as a design concept. Very interesting, I thought.
The building actually exists at 55 Central Park West. Then I think we added one number so to misidentify it, and then John McHugh decorated it a bit and then optically added that top.
I asked the prop department to come up with various kinds of real objects that are used to detect various gas leaks and things like that. And Bill went up to the sort of prop table and chose his sort of favorite, most comedy-inducing prop.
It's a sniffer.
It's a sniffer. It's what it's really called.
Well, we had actually had a consultant come up from, I think from Caltech or someplace, and we posed the question to him, if ghosts really existed, what scientific methods would there be for detecting their presence? And he talked about changes in electromagnetic fields, possible odors,
right.
Kinetic disturbances of all kinds. So there's some logic behind what we're doing here. Not
again,
that Bill understood it or cared.
But that was the character he was playing.
That's right. I love when she says, are you sure you're using that thing right? He says, well, I don't know. I think so.
Mr. Beckman, you've come all this way. Would you like to check your... Danny, of course, is really interested in the paranormal.
Yes.
And,
Well, Danny
did a lot of research.
Card-carrying psychic aficionado.
And I think member of the, what's the society called?
American Psychical Society or something. And has a show in Canada, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Psy Factor. Documentary show.
This was when Columbia was owned by Coca-Cola.
Yeah, they made us put that thing there.
So that's why Bill said something nasty about what's in the food. Look at all this junk food. Oh. That's it.
And there were flames, and I heard a voice say, Zool. It was right here.
I'm sorry, I'm just not getting any reading.
Well, are you sure you're using that thing correctly?
There's not, I think so, but I'm sure there are no animals in there.
Well, that's great. Either I have a monster in my kitchen.
Sigourney really was a great sport during the making of the film because for the very scenes that we're going to see coming up, she really had to undergo an enormous amount of hardship when she's floating around or when she's covered in soot and marshmallow and dog stuff. And
she would go off into a corner to prepare herself for a scene, and Bill, of course, would sneak up behind her and pick her up or something. Bill would like to be sort of in mid-sentence before he stepped onto the set and...
Or lift her up.
He likes
lifting women.
This is actually a key scene. I was real pleased when I saw it. I wasn't there when you guys shot it, but I thought you worked out something great with them and his decision to commit to solving her problem, to make her like him.
Yeah, thank you.
In spite of everything.
I think it's important because it again, in terms of this sort of stepping stone of reality, so that we're going to, as an audience, believe in the future of this story. And care about it. You really have to buy into this relationship and his and Bill's subtle shift from being a total doughhead to a scientist who's going to sort of get involved.
Right. And him announcing, "I'm going to solve your little problem." That really worked for me. You know.
Who came up with the talk show host line?
Actually, that was hers. That was Sigourney's line.
We had a line, "You're more like a used car salesman."
Right.
In the script, she said, "You're more like a game show host."
Locking himself out of his office.
First customer. Out of his
apartment, yes.
And this is a big moment also in the film, which is first time we're going to see the Ghostbusters in their uniform and in action as Ghostbusters.
This really was fun. This is also back in L.A. We got to slide down the pole. You know, one thing about the movie, we only did like 3 weeks in New York?
Four or 5 weeks.
That many, wasn't it?
Yeah, 4 weeks at least. But 4 weeks in New York. But it really, I think New Yorkers have sort of really take it as one of the great New York movies.
Yeah.
And because it really captures both the spirit and the feel of the city.
We got one. Is there a song by the Busboys begins?
I always thought that if the movie was going to be successful, the moment that the Ghostbusters walk into this hotel, that's the first time we really see them in full regalia, that in a perfect world, the audience should applaud. And wonderfully enough, that really happened at most of the screenings.
But I remember also, Ivan, the first time you saw the three of them together walking down the street in New York in their outfits.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that when we get to that shot. The Cedric Hotel, this is actually right up here, the Biltmore Hotel, very popular shooting spot in Los Angeles. In fact, I used this moment right here in Dave when he exits as the supposed president of the United States.
What's interesting about this kind of shot is when the movie is panned and scanned for TV, I'm always cut out.
That's right. There is no more Harold Ramis.
That's right.
So be happy you bought a DVD today and see it in the proper format.
You can see me in every shot.
Did you ever report it to anyone?
And for me, this is where the movie really kicks in and really sort of hits its sort of quirky center and energy. I love you guys getting the elevator with that couple coming up right here.
Yes. These packs weighed about 30 pounds fully loaded. We had different versions of them. Some were rubber for when we did stunts. Some had no batteries when we weren't firing the guns. The fully loaded with batteries were about 30 pounds.
They were the killer. And I must say, on your behalf, Harold, you were the one who complained the least.
Oh, no, I never complained.
That's right. Guess who complained the most? I'm not going to mention his name. Fine, I can't remember that gentleman's name, but he was a fine
Murray
old
Bloom.
Sort of great Murray Bloom, a great old character
Bloom.
Actor.
Each of us is wearing an unlicensed nuclear reactor on his back.
That's a great Ramis line.
I once read a review in some intellectual British magazine that explained this was the key moment because it's really about nuclear energy.
Someone sent me actually from a graduate school in environmental science. They took the premise of Ghostbusters about our relationship to the EPA and did a whole long dissertation on it about what it says about the EPA and its role in society based on
that,
Ghostbusters.
Right? We got that.
Yeah.
I just love the wanton destruction of this sequence. Just like sort of trigger happy cops, they start shooting at everything that moves.
Sorry. They're so apologetic, too.
Setting up Bill's line, let's split up. Yeah, we can do more damage that way.
There's a lot of work done on the sound effects of these backpacks, the guns turning it on. I remember Ivan was always wanting more bass, and more bottom to it.
Of course, the studio set, hallways.
All this equipment, like, you know, this, his eyepiece up above. Over there was sort of real amalgamation of real items and fanciful ones. And here's our most famous ghost, Slimer, got his own TV show.
I was married and divorced twice in Hollywood.
Danny Aykroyd always used to refer to Slimer as the ghost of John Belushi.
The gluttony of the ghost. as a tribute to John.
He's just a party guy looking to have a good time.
Yeah.
Just a little bit of slime after he goes through. I thought it was great.
I wish that we had the technology that we have now to do some of these scenes because it wasn't really possible to quite get the kind of realistic look that we can get on a ghost right now. But but the point was comedy and.
It
certainly was
good.
A big favorite moment.
It looks good enough, and I think the audience was just delighted. And I think a slight cartoon quality of the ghost helped.
It's right here, right? It's looking at me.
I think he's seen
it. I think the important thing here is that Bill is actually frightened, or at least playing frightened in the film. It's a real shift from what he plays in the movie up to this point, and that sort of emotional shift also adds, even though it's done for comedy, kind of a secondary emotional quality that then sort of, again, builds in our investment in the movie.
Big line here.
Yeah.
He slimed me. We take credit for turning slime into a verb.
When Ivan and I saw this in Germany, dubbed in German, and he says something like, ich bin geslime or something, sounded even better. Got
amazingly, they got it.
And this is pure Marx Brothers.
Yeah, right down to the placement of the heads as they come through the door.
Yeah.
There it is. On the ceiling.
One of my least favorite special effects.
I'm going around the chandelier.
Yeah. That was a really lousy effect. This is actually done in the ballroom of the Biltmore Hotel, which had the spectacular ceiling, to which we added, of course, the chandelier that we ruined. And we ended up shooting, I guess, in the hotel for about 3 or 4 days on the sequence. And I remember the guests going by just outside in the hallway wondering what the hell we were doing.
I think that room isn't there anymore. They've subdivided it or something. It's a shame. It should be a historic landmark.
This was the famous "Don't cross the streams" dialogue, which a lot of people have interpreted to all kinds of ways that are too scatological to go into. But
and what was it you had in mind?
I we were looking for some out, setting up something later for the movie.
So you try to make sense out of what's going on.
People thought it had something to do with urinals. I won't go into it.
I haven't heard. This is fun blowing up all the cakes.
It's, again, it's a mixture of optical effects and
acting.
Acting, of course, and physical stuff. So we have real explosions going off.
The neutrino wands, which is the thrower, actually had a flashbulb at the end. So when we triggered them, the special effects guys had something to cue the start of the stream from.
It helped the actors, too, sort of told you.
Yeah.
Isn't it great? We're really shooting now.
Yeah.
This is the closest you've been to a Western hero, I think.
Yep. The hotel manager is a good actor, too. I forgot his name. Michaelson. I've seen him in numerous other things. This, our first trapping experience was very important for setting the technology for the audience, which just seemed to fascinate a segment of the public.
Yeah.
I got so many requests. Kids would send me letters. Could you please send me a proton?
They finally manufactured
them. That's right. We, of course, then sort of...
But Danny had designed a lot of these himself before the movie.
Actually, in that three-week period that we were up in... I keep forgetting.
Martha's Vineyard.
Martha's Vineyard. He actually showed us three very key drawings, one of which was the no-go symbol.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is now being imitated on everything.
The drawings were done by a guy named John DeVicus. Who's
the Viking.
A friend of...
a friend of his from Canada, an old biker friend.
Yeah.
And then I think Mike Gross redesigned a little bit the shape of the ghost. But the basic idea was always...
Well, we had to stay away from Casper, I remember, right. Was a big problem.
By the way, that trapping... was always a very big applause point. You notice I remember all the applause points for me as a director. That's very, very important.
Because even though it's a comedy, they want these guys to try it. I remember that scene where Bill comes up and says, we kicked it fast. The three of you, three actors, sat there and you kept saying, Ivan would say, do it again. And you wouldn't tell them what you were going to say. You'd sit, stand together and think about it, go in. And I think we shot it about 10 times. About 8 of them are really funny.
Yeah, they looking for different...
They were making up the prices of what we're doing. Yeah, looking for different announcements.
Different announcements. What's the best...
What's the best,
what's the best finisher?
Anyway, thanks
so
much.
Thank you. Hope we can help you again. Coming for a one-class And one great thing about all the movies we worked on together with Bill was the... amount of invention we were allowed and how much time we would actually spend on the set, not worrying about marks or stuff like that, but just worrying about making every moment play, which was that's why I think that these movies deliver for the audience.
This guy in the background is not an extra. I remember he wandered onto the set.
And this
montage.
The montage, I remember getting permissions. I still have a few of these magazine and newspaper covers.
I was very impressed when I saw the movie put together.
Yeah. You like that, huh?
Yeah.
And that is this the first time we hear the Ghostbusters song, I think? Yeah. The Ray Parker Jr. I knew we needed a great kick-ass song.
Danny Aykroyd is actually driving the car in most of these shots. We shot it all in one day after we'd been up late the night before went off with just the car and a the guy chasing. The chasing here is not an actor. He was really chasing. That's me again.
Yeah, the guy chasing was really someone from
Rockefeller Center.
Rockefeller Center, because it was illegal to shoot there.
When we shot all this stuff on all these different locations around the city, that's when people in New York started seeing this ambulance driving around.
This is the first shot we ever shot in the movie. Bill Murray had just arrived from France. On an airplane, immediately got taken down to Midtown Manhattan, put on one of these outfits, and boom, we were shooting on Madison Avenue. I had an amazing shiver when I saw the guys in their outfits. I knew there's something special here.
But the legend over those weeks started to grow, because people would see this ambulance tearing around the city. They'd see us in uniform. What the hell is that? Ghostbusters. And that's all we'd say. You know.
Yeah, and then we used that as part of the sort of pre-publicity for the movie. We start sticking up the no-go sign without any other words, with nothing, and a date. And it started building the word for the movie.
Now, this the only sex thing in the movie.
The dream sequence.
We cut most of this out.
Yeah,
actually.
There was a long sequence set at an old fort.
Oh, that's it's funny because I remember shooting it, but it's not in.
The sequence isn't in just this dream.
Succubus.
It's just this one little moment here.
I couldn't explain to my kids.
It wasn't originally meant to be a dream sequence. And here comes
our fourth Ghostbuster, Ernie Hudson.
Yay.
Winston Zeddemore.
Get his credentials here. Like,
she's giving him the test.
Yes, do you believe it?
We used to, in the script, he used to say what his credentials were. He's way overqualified for this job. He's
been a Marine. He has a PhD. Now he just wants someone.
That's nice.
We in the movie, of course, needed someone to explain things for the audience, because obviously the three experienced Ghostbusters were supposed to know
how everything works,
what was going on, and just from a storytelling standpoint, we needed someone to say, "Well, what does this mean?"
It's interesting. One of the things that paces this movie in its time is people smoke all the time.
Yes.
By the time we did Ghostbusters 2, the Ghostbusters never smoke on camera.
No, they did ecstasy.
And here he is, Timothy Cathcart.
The other thing about Ernie is that at this point the Ghostbusters have kind of degenerated into ghost janitors, which is sort of where Dan's original script kicked in. That's where
right.
it started.
Yeah,
that we were already bored, and you know that ghosts were very mundane to us. You know, that was the tone of it.
In fact, the second Ghostbusters really picks up on that tone as well, which is you've done too good a job.
I've always presumed that this is who Sigourney married when she has a child in the second one.
Yes, the violinist.
The violinist, because this is actually Lincoln Center, of course.
Our sound man
went nuts.
Just went nuts when he saw that we were going to shoot here, and he kept saying, "Well, can we turn off the fountains?" And they wouldn't let us turn off the fountains at Lincoln Center.
Sound men are always going nuts in New York, though.
Yeah. I think it was one of the few scenes we had to loop.
Hittite. Mesopotamians and Sumerians.
Zul was the minion of Gozer. This is where he's giving you the history of the building.
Gozer was very big in Sumeria. History of Zul, I think.
Zul.
I've
already heard.
We're working on that. If we could get together Thursday night, I'm thinking 9-ish, you know, we could exchange information.
I can't see you, sir.
She looks so pretty.
Yeah.
Miss Barrett, you seem to think there is something known up here that says in your mind, Peter Barry is speaking, spending it with his
I also think Bill looks very handsome here.
Yeah.
It's a very romantic scene.
And he does that wonderful turn at the end of his idea, or
can't remember.
Any pirouettes? There's a skater out there doing it, and he mimics the skaters.
I can't remember. I'm sure it was my idea.
Sure, Ivan.
You said it was wonderful, right?
Yeah.
All right.
It's a very lyrical moment.
It's part of my oeuvre.
Moving to music. I like the balloons. Very nicely set up. This is one of those romantic New York movies at that point. Beautiful day, Lincoln Center.
He sees the guy turning and he turns.
There he goes. Whoops.
This is where we store all the vapors and amenities.
It's the first time we see what they do with the ghost. This is really an explanatory scene in terms of what's really going on. Danny just loved this.
Yeah.
And actually worked out the technology of all this. And consulted on the props and on the set.
Great sounds. Too. It's almost a flushing sound.
Like turn green, the trap is clean.
I don't even remember what they're saying here.
I think he's been visited by the EPA.
All right.
Oh, no, she's complaining about, and he says, I think there are many openings in the food service industry.
You've seen this movie, you know. You showed this to your kids recently.
This is the
action. I remember dialogue. Anything I've written, I remember very well.
15 years ago.
Walter Peck. William Atherton.
Yes.
Very good guy. Very odious in this movie, though.
And it set up immediately with that handshake. I ran into Atherton about a year after this film had come out. I was expecting him to sort of greet me with open arms because of the success of the film, and he became quite famous from the movie. And he was genuinely pissed. He came up to me and said, you know, I can't walk into a bar without people wanting to pick a fight with me. He'd scream at me and make fun of me wherever I go.
Well, the worst is that, I'll tell it now, later in the movie, Danny calls him dickless.
Yes.
Atherton told me that he was walking down the street in New York and a busload of people yelled at him, and he turned and smiled and waved, and they all went, yo, dickless!
So let me just go on record. I'm sorry, William.
He's a good actor, though.
Yeah, you're an extraordinary actor, and you deserve better.
What a good nemesis he was for Bill, though.
Now, I didn't have children when we made this movie, so when you guys wrote the line, what's the magic word?
Yeah.
I had no idea what you were talking about. You're saying, what is this line here?
Magic word is please. It all exists.
It's very intense. That's great. It's good. I think in comedies, as in dramas, the secret is strong villains.
Yeah.
You don't want a villain. Bill could walk over so many people if they weren't tough.
But he's not overplayed.
No.
You know, he's very credible. One thing that always disturbed me a little bit, I have to say, about Animal House.
You're right.
You can say it.
I thought John Landis overplayed the villains a little bit. And I can say this because I've produced it and I co-wrote it. But.
I always thought of this as a Howard Hawks moment. People lighting cigarettes for each other.
Not me, you notice.
I noticed.
And this is an extraordinarily important speech, and I can't remember the genesis of the Twinkie speech. Do you, Harold?
No.
But, I mean, I know it came at Martha's Vineyard, and we were trying to think of a very practical way of demonstrating to the world
just how dangerous things were getting. Yeah.
Yeah. And deal with it very quickly.
Yeah. And we also had this notion that Spengler snacks constantly.
I noticed that. He gets offered a chocolate bar at the beginning. And
what about the Twinkie?
One more cheesy special effect.
Not a great one.
Yeah, well.
That's an actual painting. Isn't
it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's the set, the famous set.
Now, just a word about John DeCure, the production designer. When he made this film, I guess he was in his 70s, you think?
We couldn't
really tell how old he was. The rumors were anywhere from 70 to the late 80s. He was the designer of Hello, Dolly, that extraordinary location at where he changed the back lot of 20th Century Fox. He did Cleopatra. I think he was nominated or he won 8 Academy Awards. And he's one of the great geniuses, and he knew exactly what a lens can do, how wide a set can be. And that set was built on the largest set at Columbia, which was the largest set in Hollywood at that time.
Very tall stage. The large, it's 360-degree cyclorama of the city, the backdrop. Yeah.
Which was painted in the old manor and then had to be lit by Laszlo Kovacs. And we used every generator that was available for rent in the city of Los Angeles when we had to light the damn thing up.
Fire marshals on the set around the clock.
And the set filled the stage, so there was virtually no room on either side of it.
And it was very high off the ground, too. It was almost dizzying when you're up
there. That's right.
It was about three stories off.
So that I could get really low angle shots to create that perspective of being at the top of a building.
And I remember we came out of New York ahead of schedule. You guys have been shooting like crazy and, you know, probably doing 15, 16 setups at least a day. And we got onto this set. We
that
did
was
one
the first
setup.
Day shooting in Los Angeles.
We did one setup.
It was really daunting.
I remember the word on John DeCure, people would say, he built Alexandria three times.
Yeah.
And I thought, that didn't bode real well for the budget.
But amazingly enough, the budget, as I said earlier, was $30 million. And I think we finally made the film for about $31 million. It went slightly over budget. So.
Now, I actually think this next thing that happens to Sigourney is probably one of the scariest things in the picture, at least for kids.
Well, it's probably because she's vulnerable. She's taking clothes off. I mean, it's...
Right.
Not
enough in my perspective. But I had to explain to my kids, you know, because they've been on movie sets. I had to explain that, you know, these arms, they're, you know...
Right.
These are
special
real, effects guys.
These are real
gloves,
grips.
You know? Yeah.
Real grips in the... who are actually in a trapdoor underneath this chair with their hands just below.
It's a wonderful, ominous move, too. You know something's going to happen. The camera's bending around her, but, you know, you think it's going to come from
there. And
then
there's just this cheap thing of a light behind the door.
I know. Yeah. I said, okay, well, I've seen Close Encounters of a light. And I said, if Spielberg can do those lights, I can do those lights, and we'll do it in a kind of a different way.
The door bending, of course.
Yeah, that was a rubber door.
Yeah.
We're giving away all the big ones. It's amazing how effective.
Ooh, in the hands. Yeah. Well, that would scare a kid.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
Now, I remember, you know, we didn't think this movie was really for young kids.
Yeah. I was actually advising people to not let their kids under 8 see it.
And then kids are really frightened by the Wizard of Oz, too. The flying monkeys and things. So.
Scorny loved doing that scene.
Yeah.
She loved it.
The good news was the teachers were writing to me saying that kids were playing Ghostbusters at recess and before and after school, but they loved it. The teachers liked it because it wasn't a competitive game. The kids all got together and fought ghosts instead of fighting each other, which was good.
And they didn't use guns.
Now, he improvised most of this party dialogue, which I think is brilliant.
Yes.
And it's one camera move. Watch. This is amazing. And I think he did coverage, Ivan, but never used it, just in case. But he basically did it in one move.
Yeah.
He's telling him the price of the smoked salmon,
yeah,
remember?
Yes.
he gets to deduct it because he invited clients instead of friends.
Yeah.
Casey Kasem's wife.
That's right. Making a fine entrance.
Gene Kasem, is that her name?
Yeah, yeah. Genie.
Genie.
Oh, don't move. I just got
to get the camera. All the same shot.
All the same shot. Amazing.
Ted and Annette. They have a small dry cleaning business.
He just keeps pumping.
Yeah. I have to take some credit. I helped Rick on some.
This is funny.
This is a big
this
moment.
This is great. That was good to diffuse.
This is an odd sequence of effects.
Yeah.
This next one. He's optical, clearly.
Yes. And very badly done.
Yeah.
Very badly. It didn't seem to matter.
That's real.
That's great. The puppet work was wonderful.
That's odd when I say to my kids, that's real.
Like, yes.
My 4-year-old says, it's real?
It's real.
Can I get that?
No, it's a real puppet.
I love this image.
Yeah. And then taking the sequence out into the street was great fun.
This was shot before the Harold or Danny were around. Never, besides Bill was still in.
Yeah, was this in October? When
this was when we went a week early.
That's right.
We shot for
Thank
like
you
5 days.
Me.
Most of this.
Yeah, I remember because of the amazing schedule we were under, which was that we started writing in May or June of '83, and the movie was going to be out in June of
another
'84.
That was added by us. This is the Rio.
And that. So I decided I would do, just arbitrarily, 3 days of shooting without the main cast in October, when actually we started the principal photography in November.
This is the Rio Tavern in the Green.
Yes, amazingly they let us shoot there.
Nice doggy.
This is kind of scary for kids, I think.
But again, people's reactions.
and a New York moment.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
everyone just goes back what they're doing. So.
And this is, I think, the street that we created on the back lot at Columbia.
Right.
Yeah.
The Columbia Studios.
The old Columbia Ranch.
Was it on the ranch?
Yeah.
It was the Warner Ranch.
It's now the Warner Ranch.
Yeah. Is, yeah.
And it was, we did it so we could do the earthquake there.
Right. The street opening up. This is a great scene.
Yeah. The, in fact, you know, I did the show Merlin on Broadway with Doug Henning, and he had a flying, trick in the show, and that's where I learned how we could do this sort of 360 degree turn, which is a very tough thing to pull off live. So this next sequence is all live. There are no special no optical effects in it at all. It was all done. And I think it's what allows the actors to both improvise and respond to the reality of that situation in a way that you can't when you're sort of pretending with optical effects.
He is the keymaster. He was the keymaster.
Are you the keymaster?
I'm the gig. There's something sexual about that too, isn't there?
Well.
Yes. Wow, great shot.
Everything in life is either sexual or political, so take your pick.
Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
That's it.
This is one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Yeah.
I think I actually do the voice, the deep voice of...
you do?
Yeah, that's me.
Kids find that very scary, too.
Yeah, I did Slimer, and I did the voice comes out of her here.
The exorcist voice.
Some of this dialogue, do you want this body? This is a trick question and stuff like that. And she says, I want you inside me. And he says, I think there are enough people in there already.
Yeah, that's a great sequence. That was written. A lot of people think that was improvised.
Now, Bill has the good sense to do a line as written when it's really strong. Everything else is up.
Otherwise, no one but I never get involved with clients. Well, maybe I'm an exception.
Yeah,
everything's up for grabs. If it's working, no. He knows when it's working.
Yeah. Most actors seem to have that instinct.
Yeah.
Well, there's some exceptions. But no one improvises like Bill Murray, I have to say. Give the guy credit.
Sigourney's having a great time here, and she's really good.
Now, she's got a full body cast on to take the weight, her weight, as she starts to rise. And it's on a pivot. It's got a built-in steel band around it that pivots around an arm that... hidden in the drapery and that you can't see because of the camera angle. I always sort of kept the level of the camera at the same level as the sort of horizontal pole so that you can't see it on film.
This is the scene she auditioned with, right?
The
camping scene? Like?
She did this, and then she actually became... I mean, it's a little different than this. But.
Now, we had to reshoot this scene, because we were sitting in Daly saying how good it was, and Shelley, I think, said, look over in the corner, and you could see a shadow of the arm. It's not
it wasn't the arm. No, you saw a guy. There was a guy in the shot. Yeah, I think he was sitting, way over there in the far corner.
And no one was looking at him.
That's
except
right.
The editor.
Everybody was looking at the sequence.
Yeah. So we had to go back and nowadays you just, of course, after...
We didn't have video replay then either. Most of this film was done...
Yeah, that's true.
We didn't have video replay, so everything was being done live. And this is it. I mean, you would do this optically
nowadays.
But
easily,
but she's there and she's turning and he had all this to play with.
Yeah,
and he could touch her.
And if there was something showing, you just erase it later.
Yeah.
No, we couldn't do that in those
days.
That's
true.
This is 6th Avenue, is it?
Yeah, it was between the two Ghostbusters that the digital revolution happened. Which Richard Edlund, who did the effects for this picture, he said the whole industry in special effects was expecting the change from optical to digital to be a slow dissolve, he said. Instead, it was a hard cut.
That's right. Warm.
Vince Clortho, key master of Gozer. Vulgus Sildrawar, Lord of the Sebulia. Are you the gatekeeper? Hey, he pulls the wagon.
This is in the middle of the night near Central Park, I remember.
This is a stand-up comedian who was so nervous about working on this movie, he could barely get his lines out in the initial shooting.
Yeah, he does a great Rodney Dangerfield.
That's right. He, and he's done great since then.
What an asshole.
I love her line. Pick up or deliver.
Dropping off or picking up.
Yeah. With that great voice.
Yeah.
We picked up this guy. Now we don't know what to do with him. Bellevue doesn't want him, and I'm afraid to put him in the lockup. And I know you guys are into this stuff, so I figured we'd check with you.
You were the best dressed Ghostbuster.
Yeah. Well, I still have the suit.
He still wears it.
I'm not, I just wish I could get in it.
You better bring him inside.
And an interesting story point that starts happening here is you get the sense of how the city is involved officially or unofficially with the Ghostbusters, where they look to them for help and another great prop.
A colander.
It's a colander with a lot of fancy wires on top. We figured the sillier the better.
Well, you figured the Ghostbusters had to manufacture their own equipment. So.
Yeah. The idea that they were hobbyists who made things from their own materials.
Do you want some coffee, Mr. Tully?
Do I?
Yes, have some.
Yes, have some.
Vince, you said before you were waiting for a sign. What sign are you waiting for?
It's another bit of sleight of hand we did here while we shot live instead of optically, where we used that same machinery that we saw on Sigourney, and as the camera moves across, Rick ducked out, and we put the head of one of those rubber dummies of the terror dog in, so it would appear like.
Or as if that was,
was what's inside of him.
You worked with Rick in Toronto in SCTV, didn't you, Harold?
No, we didn't overlap there. He came to SCTV after. But I directed Rick in Club Paradise, of course. The failed romance.
All this furniture would be very valuable now. It's all come back into fashion.
Peter, thanks, I've got it. I have some news from the world of Gozer.
What is it, Peter?
I'm here with Dana Barrett. It seems the Goze has been putting some moves on my would-be girlfriend.
How is she?
I think we can get her a guest shot on Wild Kingdom. I just whacked her up with about 300 cc's of Thorazine. She's going to take a little nap now. But
the plot is starting to heat up. We've got the gatekeeper. She's the gatekeeper. We've got the keymaster.
Yes.
So you notice this water is boiling.
Yeah, that's right. And a great dead tag take from Harold.
Well, just for you acting buffs out there, I've made a decision not to smile in this entire movie. That's about as close to a smile as I get.
Bad news, honey. I gotta go to work. Hey, will you stay here in bed until I get back?
These Spengler fans. He was described in the script as a new age Mr. Spock. I tried to play him that way.
This is the shot.
I think our one and only helicopter shot that we were able to use.
I think the car, this is where the car died at the end. I always love this scene. It's very quiet. There are no jokes.
Well, now that we're sort of coming close to the millennium, interesting conversation.
Yeah, it's a key piece of dialogue.
Really right from the heart and head of Danny Aykroyd.
I think connecting it to the Bible was an idea we'd talked about.
And later on in the mayor scene, you could see how people keep quoting that material. It really did hit a nerve. There was a great earthquake, and the sun
became as black as sackcloth. Disaster of biblical implications?
Mm-hmm. Disaster of biblical proportions.
Person, biblical proportions.
It's the cats and dogs.
Dogs and cats living together.
Which is, I think, the line that seems to hold. And a nice scene for Ernie, who unfortunately didn't get much of an opportunity, what with the other three guys.
Of course, Ernie and I were reunited in the movie Airheads.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I'm sorry, I missed that one.
Oh, that's
Duncan Fraser. Hey, what's his name?
Adam Sandler.
Adam Sandler. Come on, Steve Buscemi. Me.
Hey, what else? Ernie?
Ernie.
Beautiful shot, huh?
I had a cameo. Yeah. Ernie was featured. That is a great shot of the Brooklyn Bridge. I think Godzilla ripped you off on that one.
Yeah. They all did over the years.
I always like the low angle on this too. This was good.
This is where sort of this is my comment on bureaucracy, you see.
My memory is that this guy had been a cop.
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, he is one of the famous New York cops.
Oh, no, hold on. I've seen TV. I know you can't come in here without a warrant or a writ or something.
Cease and desist all commerce order. Seizure of premises and chattels. Ban on the use of public utilities for non-licensed waste.
That was one of those great Aykroyd lists.
A catalog. Did Danny act like catalogs? Look how Rick's sniffing behind you. It's Igor.
He loved doing that.
I'm warning you. Turning off these machines would be extremely hazardous.
I'll tell you what's hazardous. You're facing federal prosecution for at least a half a dozen environmental violations.
Now, I always liked the guy who played the Con Ed guy.
Yeah, he's actually a fine comedian. Okay.
Look at Rick over here. You're acting your way.
He's in his own movie.
That's a perfect thing to do. I would have been doing the same if I'd been upstage.
He had no lines. He had to work.
Right.
Well, now it is my turn.
How about the cop fighting for the light?
This is a good moment. I always thought this was very strong.
It's strong. Because Bill plays it with not a trace of irony, and it's one of the few times in the movie he does it, a few times in his career, that he does it and plays it absolutely straight, and I think it takes on a lot of sort of real weight.
Pencil neck, he calls him.
Uh-oh.
Boom.
Sneak out.
And all this intercutting is kind of cute. Again. We did most of this practically. We're using lights and a lot of guys shaking individual bricks from behind, and dust and wind.
Great thing about practical special effects is these guys have done everything. You tell them you want to fire a cinder block across the room.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
That was
how fast you want to go on.
Yes. And
I remember
all this. We were just
throwing stuff from
crying.
Coming in there.
I remember the stuff coming down. Someone ran out and from the wardrobe department and said, "Egon's suit. It's the only one we have. Don't get it wet."
That's right.
What's in this? What's in this liquid?
Yeah.
It's the car and Egon's suit. We're one of a kind.
And of course, my hair. I got married after the second Ghostbusters, and my hair was still tall and big, and Bill was always giving me trouble about my hair in this movie. So as I'm walking down the aisle to meet my new bride, Bill says loud enough for all the wedding guests to hear, "Your hair is perfect."
And it was wonderful to see you actually get physical at that moment.
Yeah.
You know, the brain man, you know, suddenly having this sort of
I love this shot.
Take and fight.
This is a great set.
This was taken from next door to 55. I remember we went up, Ivan, to the apartment building next door to 55 Central Park West and got as high as we could to photograph the city. Well, this might have been from your hotel room, actually.
It could have been.
One of them we went to your hotel room and photographed. Great shot.
Now, we actually did this next sequence live, not with the ghosts over here. This is all part of that very early shooting that we did back in October, as I remember. And but the sequence of Sigourney at the window and it all exploding out.
Ghost cab driver.
Also from the first week of shooting on Madison Avenue.
Stunt. Is This is Broadway, I think.
We Ghostbusters was the first movie I shot in New York. And, you know, people were telling me how rough it is to shoot there. But I actually fell in love with the experience because, you know, the whole, it's a cliche, but the whole place is like an extraordinary set. And the people are, the extras give you so much more than you get anywhere else.
This is when you shot your men, Ivan.
Yeah, this is an actual set that we sort of cut in. And Sigourney actually stood there through this following explosion.
She's there.
She's there, and I have got a big tight lens, I think, at about 300 or 400 millimeter on her for this close-up in slow motion, because I had the sense that if we could capture her like that, it would be very powerful.
This is actually
Danny's friend.
The jail in Lower Manhattan.
This is one of Danny's friends.
Yeah, this gentleman over there.
This is Larry Bilzerian right here, ladies and gentlemen, smoking a cigarette in a motorcycle jacket.
I'm not sure about all the other guys.
Yes, this was a real jail, deserted, I believe.
Was this Rikers?
No, it was in the middle of like around.
Yeah, we were in Manhattan somewhere.
14th Street or something.
And Danny claimed it was haunted, and our film got scratched. We had to cut around the.
This the building explanation coming up.
Yes. Your girlfriend.
Yeah, do you remember the genesis of that? I know there were some famous stories from the turn of the century about weirdness in New York. And I wish we should add Danny Aykroyd again.
Pretty much me and Dan making it up. Dan and I had a lot of fun working on this, on the pseudoscience of this thing, you know.
These are actually blueprints to my new home.
You're almost smiling here, Harold.
Well, with cynical delight, because we're talking about the evil rituals they performed.
Right. I think this will be a big player during the upcoming millennium celebrations.
Yeah, if the world doesn't end.
If the projectors work.
If the world does end, all that money people are spending on DVDs is really wasted. just a side note, Larry Bilzerian, the guy in the black leather jacket, has a great clothing store on Martha's Vineyard called Take It Easy, Baby.
This is Bill's thing. You better watch out.
And the policeman, Reggie Vell Gleason?
Yeah.
Vell Johnson.
Vell Johnson.
Yeah, this was his first movie.
Yeah.
Then he went on to do movies and a television series. Comes in and says, okay, Ghostbusters.
That's it.
The mayor wants to. Here he is. Reggie.
Nice guy, too.
Yeah.
Ivan, you fired an extra on this day. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. There was some guy sort of mouthing off.
He mouthed off.
You out.
And he thought
you'd never
come
back.
He thought you were kidding, and you said, no, I'm serious. Get out.
Yeah, well, it was a police station. Things can get out of control.
All right, now I should say here that when the...
Pretty neat shot, if I do say so myself.
Very good, very good. I'll save the explanation of what happened when we shot the big scene.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I remember. It's a beautiful shot there. Rick's actually a bit of a clothes horse. He likes good clothing, but he says he never wants to keep any of his costumes.
And supporting doing what comes naturally.
This is so funny.
Gatekeeper and the keymaster.
And I remember doing this dolly in and zooming out thing as they walk forward. It wasn't quite the cliche it has become since then, sort of to create the kind of weird effect of...
Scorsese ripped you off, man.
Yeah. God damn it.
This is actually the...
Actually City Hall.
Yes. So no one knows where it is in New York. Everyone thinks the courthouse is City Hall, but this is the City Hall.
We were given amazing access, actually, by the filming group in New York.
I think part of it, too, is that Bill and Dan are like folk heroes in New York, just because they're Saturday night years, and They're really beloved there.
This was, I believe, Elizabeth Holtzman's office. It's my memory. It's
yeah,
memory.
Not the actual mayor's office.
It's a twin to it, which is the other side of the building.
This is another favorite of mine in terms of the scene. Both the biblical rap and the dogs and cats.
We brought the mayor back for Ghostbusters 2, of course.
Right. He's David Margulies is the mayor, and of course he's become quite famous playing the mayor of New York in quite a number of other movies.
I think I just saw him in Celebrity, Woody Allen's movie.
Was he the mayor?
No. He was an artist or a writer or something. How do you explain that? It's a fine moment.
Especially that cutaway reaction shot. I think I like this scene because it sort of it tries to imagine what this kind of meeting would be like with all the sort of heads of the various departments and bureaucracies in a large city like this.
A particular resonance for Bill, who was from a big Catholic family, is that there was a Murray, Archbishop of New York.
Yes.
Yeah, in their family.
And then he gets to be the raisonneur.
Yeah. It's a very fine moment for him, I think.
Yeah. These things are real. Since I've joined these men, I have seen shit that'll turn you white.
Well, you can believe Mr. Pecker.
My name is Peck.
Or you could accept the fact that this city is headed for a disaster of biblical proportion.
What do you mean, biblical?
This sort of acting style and the sort of the whole tone of the movie we should talk about for a moment, because it's often not given, you know, the actors are not given enough credit, I think. It's easy to do things in a sort of silly style, and it's also pretty easy to do things dead natural and kind of sort of romantic comedies and play oneself. There's a heightened reality, of course, that goes on in this whole movie, and just finding the right acting tone and level for the performers and for the director is kind of a very tricky and delicate thing. And in a scene like this where it's very easy to get very really silly with it and push it way over bounds, and at the same time, underplaying doesn't quite give it enough humor. It's just finding that middle ground that sort of delivers the goods, both comedically and emotionally and from a story standpoint.
Well, Bill has an undeniable reality. I mean, he can't do anything that's not real. He resists it. And
what really helps the comic actors in the scene are is the reality of somebody like David Margulies, who's the mayor, or William Atherton, really fine dramatic actors.
This is a great shot, because my memory is you go up, and what happens, a Steadicam operator ran around and then got on, it's a later one where he gets on
the
plane.
I think that's in Ghostbusters 2, isn't it? I can't remember. I'm confusing.
I've never seen it before. This is where Ivan told the National Guard they're a bunch of pussies. Get them going.
That's right. You call yourself soldiers? And one more cheesy special effect.
Oh, they're hard to do in those days.
Some of the really bad special effects in this film really caused some of the movie critics to wonder whether it was a deliberate style choice.
All right, so this is at 65th and Central Park West. So what happens is, there's the east-west cross through the park at 65th and 66th. Columbus Circle is just up the street. So when we were shooting this scene for 3 days, we stopped traffic here, which shut down Columbus Circle, which shuts down 8th, Broadway, 7th, and 59th Street.
No problem.
Shut the east-west pass through the park. Traffic started backing up to Times Square, then to Herald Square, then to Union Square, east side, all the way to the river. And they told us at one point we'd shut down about 60% of Manhattan during this shot.
Yeah. But it was worth it. It looked great. And it was a great location.
All right, so we're taking a break one day, and Danny and I are standing at 65th and Central Park West, and Danny sees Isaac Asimov.
I remember that.
He lives in the neighborhood. And Danny was so excited. He was one of the great science fiction writers of our age. Mr. Asimov, Dan Aykroyd, we're shooting the Ghostbusters movie here. He says, are you the ones responsible for this? Dan says, yeah. He says, it's disgusting. And he walks away. He couldn't get home.
We were all living at the Mayflower Hotel, a bunch of us. I was living at the Mayflower Hotel. It was just down the street. And people would come out and say, what are they doing here? Like, they're wrecking the city. Who are these people? And I'd say, Francis Coppola's making a cotton club.
Yeah, I remember there was a guy who was trying to get through, a really obnoxious guy in a car in the area. And he started giving the policemen who were working on the film some real grief. They just pulled him out of the car and they arrested him.
Here's a great switch from the real Central Park West to the back lot. This is all on the back lot now.
Right, all these effects. John DeCure basically recreated the street in front.
Two floors of the building.
Yeah, actually three floors, so I could get wide enough for the shot. And these are all on hydraulics underneath so that we could redo it over and over again. And they would repaste a little bit, and there's...
Then in New York, where that police car just slid into the street, they took a police car and just literally cut the front half off the car and laid it into the hole in the street.
And they had
a fake hole in the street.
Yeah, and they had the fake sidewalk on top of the fake pavement on top of the real pavement. And I was having a breakfast meeting with someone who came by and said, aren't you guys supposed to be shooting up the street? And I said, yeah. He said, I don't think you're going to be able to. Like, there's been a car fell through the ground there.
Yeah, the... It's a really wonderful mix. I think this was shot actually in New York. I can't even remember now.
This certainly is
in New York. But the
Climbing Out is New York.
Yeah. That's right.
It was just the actual breakup was in L.A. and then all this is New York again.
I was amazed when I saw that when we came back to L.A. and saw that set how accurate it was.
Ghostbusters.
But again, getting back to how good the New York extras were. I mean, they really loved doing this and. You get so much color and variety and in the characters and what they're willing to do.
Big comic moment, all that energy, let's go and get them. Crowd cheering, cut to us walking up the stairs.
This is
a matte painting.
Yeah, there's one or two stairs and everything up there is a matte painting.
This was actually shot at the Biltmore Hotel. I think everything above this line is phony.
But when we get to 20, tell me. So you didn't really have to carry all the equipment up there, Harold.
No, they still complained. Climbing.
Oh, another great shot.
Back on the big stage, stage 14, I guess, right?
22,
isn't it? Is it? No, I think
it's 18.
18. I don't know. Okay.
Well, who cares?
It's 14.
It's one of them. Harold says it's 14. I don't think it's right.
Scorny loved wearing this dress. This outfit, a lot went into that design.
Well, the designer was the only
Aldrich. Great Broadway designer who I had worked with actually on Merlin. Hmm. No, on
Merlin.
On Merlin, yeah.
Yeah.
And Gloria Gresham did the second one, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the second one, you were talking about extras. I remember we shot at Union Square, and after take one, the students came out of the house in the shot. So we suddenly went from like 300 extras to 600 extras.
To about 4,000 by the end of the evening.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful. Now, that's not an optical. That's the behind
backlit it. Backing.
The whole rooftop sequence took a few weeks to film. It was all on this stage. The Ghostbusters are actually in there in that shot in that hole. When you get closer, you can see, the guys walking around in there.
Where did those stairs go?
Oh. Well, this is when I remember the someone was saying you guys worked so well together that you would argue over who was going to get the line. Everyone offering it to someone else.
Yeah. What's wonderful about this group of actors is that there was really not a competition for who's going to say the line, although there was some competition of who could come up with the best line. Yeah. There was a lot of sort of very easy give and take in terms of who should take it. Most oftentimes, the person who came up with the line offering it to somebody else.
I have to say, at Second City training, which, you know, one of the mottos of Second City is if you concentrate on making the other person look good, then everyone looks good. So that's the way we work. And also Danny and I felt we were there as writers. I mean,
yeah.
It was,
well, there's an extraordinary advantage for a director to be able to work with the writers on the set, both as performers or just to have them there. And
well, actually, Dan had, Rick had directed a picture by then. I directed.
That's right, Danny.
And Danny
was going to direct.
And Dan used to say, three directors, no waiting.
Billy directed after this.
Yes, he did. Co-directed.
Yeah, co-directed. That's true. Did do it again.
Actually, he had directed prior to that. No. He had done Razor's Edge.
No, he didn't direct it.
John Byram did.
Oh, yeah. I thought he had co-directed. Huh?
This is a great. This is the Wild Bunch shot.
Yeah.
Well, I thought the mythology of the Westerns had a part to play here in terms of, again, how the shots were laid out and the bravery of our heroes.
But no Western ever faced a villain as menacing as the Yugoslavian fashion model. What's her name?
Oh, God.
Slavitska.
Slavitska.
Slavitska. There she is.
She was
awesome.
She was great because, one, she had to wear these silly red contacts. They've made them much more comfortable right now, but they're very painful for her. She was always harnessed up so she could flip around any way we needed to. And again, someone who really took this part extraordinarily seriously and had a wonderful grace in her movement and really had a sense of what she had to do.
Remember, you offered it to Anna Carlisle, who was like a punk rock singer at the time. Remember?
Big mistake, Anna.
And her complaint was, she said, no, the women in this, the chicks in this movie are just there to be had.
Is Danny giving one of his...
One of my favorite speeches.
Return to your...
That's right. I remember telling him...
Origins.
Okay, just play him like a cop right here.
Yeah, this is his early Jack Webb imitation.
Yeah.
It's before he did Dragnet.
Look at that blinking.
Are you a god?
No.
No. A lot of people remember this moment. Do you remember you offered Sandra Bernhardt Annie Potts' role?
Yes. Yeah. This is Bill was really acting this day. It's all the digging up and climbing.
She said, choose or perish, yeah? Juice or berries?
Juice or berries.
Yes. There's a long improvisational sequence involving Jews and berries.
Because she
being misunderstood as choose or perish.
No, but
from choose or perish.
From choose or perish. I guess it's the real Western.
We left that on the cutting floor.
Make them hard.
This is a little bit from our Stripes experience.
It sort of helped that we had so much history going into this movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
For those of you who don't know that history, Ivan produced Animal House, which I co-wrote, and then Meatballs, I worked on the script, which Ivan directed, and Bill starred in, then Stripes, Ivan directed and produced, and you also, right?
Yes, I was. Yeah.
And I co-wrote and co-starred with Bill, and that was all prelude to this. It's like our early work.
But you and, in fact, met when Ivan produced the National Lampoon show on Broadway.
Yes.
Which was Harold.
Oh, I have a good story.
Yeah, Harold, Bill.
I remember going to the first sort of audition. Now, the National Lampoon show precedes Saturday Night Live, and it starred Harold and Bill, as well as Bill's brother Brian, and Gilda Radner, and John Belushi, and... I came, it was New York, and it was a cold, wintry day, and I showed up at one of the first rehearsals, and they did this extraordinary group of talent, the likes of which I had never seen in my life coming from Canada, and they did this this first scene, and I was sitting in the corner laughing my ass off, and then I had the temerity to sort of stand up and say, you know, you think you could, and I can't remember what it was, I sort of made some very minor suggestion about what to do. Everybody just sort of stopped and looked at me like I had sort of crawled in from some other place. Bill Murray walks over to the hook where my coat was, picked it up, put it around my shoulder, patted me on the back and said, see you later.
I remember as he walked you to the door, he actually put your scarf on and opened the door for you.
Just to give you a sense of the bravery that it took to deal with these guys in those days. The wonderful thing about actually all of them, but particularly Bill was, and John Belushi, I remember from those days, was they knew they were going to be stars. They were making $300 a week doing this goofy off-Broadway show, but they thought of themselves as stars even then. They had the knowledge of their ability and their talent.
This is that I knew they were going to be stars, too, and I made a vow, never leave these guys. Just stick with them as close as you can.
Well, I always thought one of the most fortunate things that ever happened to me was that Harold Ramis, of all the rest of the cast of this show, was not chosen to be on Saturday Night Live. So I was able to go to Harold and say, you know, we ought to make a movie out of this show. And that movie eventually became Animal House and really started our careers in the movie business.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you had quite a head start in the movie business.
Yeah, making those horror movies.
Yeah.
Now, this was in Dan's original script.
Yeah.
It's one of the few scenes that was exactly... And I was worried, what are people going to think?
I was frightened about it. This was the sort of, remember, the domino steps of reality. I always thought that this was an extraordinarily large step that may not work.
Wow.
And at that very first screening, 3 weeks after shooting that we had, this was the thing that I was the most concerned about. And we fortunately had one marshmallow shot. We didn't have this one that we're looking at right now, but we had the one previous where you just saw the head going through the buildings and maybe one other. And I was sitting there, and the screening had been going extraordinarily well, people cheering and stuff. And when he first appeared in that shot, they just went nuts. And we all, because frankly, we had no other way to go. I remember talking with you, Harold, about what were we going to do when this didn't work?
No, that the response was phenomenal. And you know, they did such, the rendering, the design work on him is so good. He's so appealing and yet so menacing at the same time.
Oh, but you described him that way in the script. I remember it said, one of the great American icons.
Yeah.
You're friendly, but at this size.
I think eventually they actually made a marshmallow brand with him on it.
Now, everyone should know, the water coming out of there is actually sand, because water will not miniaturize. So they use sand. It's granular.
And all these people in New York were being told what was coming down the street.
Yeah, it's a wonderful...
Mother pus bucket. Invented obscenity.
That's right. As we become... That last shot is so badly rendered that, in fact, he is walking through the church that is right next door to the building.
Oh, look at them cry. You feel bad for them, though.
Nobody steps on a church in my town.
There's a lot of New York chauvinism in this. There you go. Burnt marshmallow.
You know, the whole crossing the stream thing, I think we invented... I don't remember that in the screenplay. I think we got there at the top of the building as we kept sort of struggling with how we were going to get to a finish. I mean, how are we going to kill this guy once and for all? And I think the crossing streams had come up in the screenplay, but this whole scene I remember working out on stage.
Yes.
Why not? It would be bad.
The door swings both ways. That was the idea. That you said it would be bad.
Hey, Gunnar, what would happen?
Like a young child coming to its senses.
I said, there's definitely a slim chance we may survive.
I love this plan.
Yeah. I think one of the nicest reviews we got for this movie said that the whole film was like a perfectly told joke.
this is beautiful. This is like from a Western. You know, you guys looking at each other, ready to go do it.
I'm working with you, Dr. Brinkman.
Yeah. Butch, Sundance, Izzy, and Mo.
Did it ever bother you having the air things blowing in your face all the time?
No, actually, I even today I have a guy walking around with a little Mole Richardson fan. It looks good to have your hair blowing a little bit.
I'm going to think it was always smoke it up and then get the fans going. Yes. Great shot.
All the pyro shots now, yeah.
The pyro was decent.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this marshmallows. What it really is shaving cream, big laundry bags or garbage bags full of it, that we dropped on everybody first here in New York for real, and then later on in our back lot set, including this, and this spectacular one.
It's beautiful.
Just before we were going to shoot that, William Atherton came up to me and said, look, is this going to hurt? I said, you know, I don't really know.
I'm not going to try it out.
No one's ever dropped 2,000 pounds of shaving cream on an anchor.
And so I thought, well, I better try it out on a stunt guy. And it was no problem, and we finally dropped it on him.
No one noticed, though, that they used menthol shaving cream. And someone, I can't remember, had a bad reaction to the menthol.
That
burned their skin a little bit.
I always love the tactility of breaking up.
This was a little conceit here that we were just covered head to toe, every inch. And Bill's going to come out with like one little fleck on his shoulder.
That's right. But this was too much of an inside joke, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, because people actually told me later that they didn't find this part realistic. There was no problem with the marshmallow man, but the fact that he didn't get any.
Yeah. Well, we thought that was a bit highly ironic.
You okay? Yes. But he just didn't want to get it on his hair.
This set was so big that I remember for one of the shots, and I think we passed it, we had to open the doors of the stage and pull the camera outside.
Yeah, to get back far enough.
To get back far enough for, I think, one of the shots where it was inserted into a mat. I always loved the tactility of this.
Yes.
I just forgot.
I also buy Bill's sincerity here.
And here she comes.
Roasted tear dog. She's inside the tear dog.
I remember there was a little bit of hurry up to this because she was actually sealed inside that thing.
That's right.
And we had to move rather quickly.
And there's just so much that this could take. Although, in the cutting, actually, I increased how long it took to get her out.
Must
by repeating shots on angle.
Right.
The rebirth metaphor. Would you like to comment on that?
Yes.
But you animal lovers should know that no terror dogs were actually killed or injured in the making of this movie.
What happened?
Rick Moraz just kept scoring one after another in this area. He just one great line after a silly line.
Where the Ghostbusters, who does your taxes?
Yeah.
He had Bill out of the way because he was in a romantic mode, so he got to he got to play front.
Are you okay?
More New York talk here. Ernie's last line.
Danny Aykroyd loved the shaving cream more than anybody else, and kept asking for more. Just load us on.
And for me, from my vanity, it's not the way you want to finish your movie. Shaving cream, you know. It's like.
And, of course, this sequence was shot long after the end of the movie.
There you go. This is our New York. This is obviously in New York. Not quite as much shaving cream.
We shot this at the end of shooting in New York. And I had this just wonderful feeling while we were filming the sequence.
Ivan Reitman.
Ivan Reitman, right there.
And that kiss was very sincere.
One of the writers.
They got along very well, Bill and Sigourney, I have to say.
The heart of the Ghostbusters.
The Marlboro Man.
Yeah. There is, yeah.
And hey, this is about all we had left of the relationship, which we shot.
<That's> But Rick gets her in the next film, I guess.
Yeah, we made a shift in the story.
Made more sense. Doesn't anyone want to interview me? I want to go with them.
I like movies that end this way, too, where you get a chance to see the characters as they come out of what they've done and get a sense of where they're going.
You again.
Yeah, well, hey, I worked hard.
You did. You really did. I was so impressed when I saw the movie cut together.
Great John McHugh, the master builder. Sheldon Klein has been working with us ever since.
Yeah.
David Blewett. All right. Bernie Brillstein. Really putting heart and soul into it.
A lot of people keep talking about this guy. I actually got a letter.
We were already selling the t-shirts.
Yeah. We knew those t-shirts were going to be sellers.
Richard Edlund did a great job, and I worked with Richard subsequently on the Multiplicity. He did all the effects on that.
And you know, Elmer Bernstein is sort of undercredited in this film because of the popularity of the Ghostbusters song. You know, people tended to overlook the score, which I think is really wonderful.
And I remember we got one chance at this shot because the stop, the light came down just as we were doing the shot, and they said it was their... it was the 16.5 millimeter camera, so they could do that. And that last shot, and they said it was they could only do one take because they lost all the light immediately.
And we should mention that Ray Parker's song was a big hit. And,
It was actually the biggest hit of that year.
And it was on Court TV, I think it was. Tom Stevens, good camera operator.
Yeah. Chuck Gasper and Joe Day came back and did Ghostbusters 2.
John DeCure Jr. as Star Trek.
Who's gone on, he did...
Jackie Ackerman, remember? One of the great prop men.
Used him many times.
Yeah.
It's one of his names.
Van Engelman.
I thought it was really one of the great experiences of my life. Yeah. And I want to thank you.
Thank you, Ivan. It was great, really.
It was good, guys. We had a secretary?
My baby told me three times nice. Please, let's make some. I believe it's magic. I believe it's magic. I believe it's magic. Hand and walk with me, so I'll tell you, Mickey, I do believe in the power of love, your magic wand, the thing that makes me sing this song, please.